You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the line is Cindy Steele, the wife of Edgar J. Steele. Cindy, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Dave. I really appreciate having this opportunity.
Cindy, this case has attracted quite a bit of attention, and it's multifaceted, but I want the listeners to really get an idea of what's going on here. Cindy, who is Edgar J. Steele, besides, of course, being your husband?
He's been a First Amendment attorney. He's been an attorney for over 25 years and has represented a lot of various people for pro bono over the years in defending our First Amendment rights of freedom of speech.
Okay. How long have you been married to Ed?
25 years.
Okay. And you have some children together?
We have 3 children, a girl, a boy, and then a girl, and the youngest is going to be 21 this year. And I have 1 granddaughter.
Okay.
Or we have 1 granddaughter.
So Ed's been an attorney for about as long as you've been married to him then, right?
Well, I guess I would have to say 26 years. He was just starting out, and I met him in his first job as an attorney, and he had just started in that law firm. And shortly after we got married is when he went on his own into private practice. So just about the amount of time that we've been married, he's been an attorney. Because prior to that, he had obtained degrees in accounting and business.
Okay, so he ain't no dummy.
Not at all. He also served in the U.S. Coast Guard and was a lieutenant in the U.S. Coast Guard for I don't know how many years, because that was before I knew him.
Okay, he was an officer in the Coast Guard.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How old is Ed, Cindy?
He just turned 65 last year.
Okay. So as an attorney, did he have a particular specialty?
His specialty when we were in California was personal injury, but he moved more into First Amendment once we moved up to the Idaho area.
Okay. And of course, he represented, well, an infamous group known as Aryan Nations. Is that right?
Yes, he did. Back in 99-2000, he took the Aryan Nation case on. He kept being approached, and it took about 3 times before he agreed to take that case on because he knew how much the group was disliked by so many in this area, but he felt that they were being railroaded based on their beliefs, and thus he did agree to take that case on because he felt they were denying this group freedom of speech that we're all entitled to. He did not take it on because he had beliefs or followed the Aryan Nations, but he strongly believes we all have the right to speak according to our First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so he didn't particularly associate or affiliate with Aryan Nations. He felt that simply because we have the First Amendment, he was going to do what he could because nobody else wanted to help them. Is that right?
That's correct. He was not associated with them and has never been associated with them.
And this trial ended in 2000, and the trial ended up in favor of the, I guess, the government. Aryan Nations lost, Ed lost, and what happened after that?
Ed basically went on his way, but I think this was at the time that Ed started sort of changing some of his political views because in regards to that case, our family started getting death threats because my husband had taken on that case. We got some very serious death threats. In fact, each one of my children received a personal death threat as well as myself and my husband.
How did these death threats arrive?
On our answering machine, except for my son. He personally answered the phone, and they threatened him. Those are all online and can be heard. Mine, actually, besides calling me a kike and a few other lovely words, at the end of it says that the FBI would love to see us dead. They were threatening my youngest, who was 9 at the time, that they were going to kill us in front of her. I don't remember them all word for word, but they're pretty ugly threats, and they were threats that we took serious enough that Ed had me pack up our children and went away for a while.
You said that they're online. The listeners can hear those threats?
If you go to the free-edgar-steele.com website, there is an outline of the whole case that sort of timelines from the beginning of Ed's career clear through this current case that is going on, and there is a portion in there where those links to all those threats are on that page where people can listen to those threats.
Okay, and of course, Steele has an E at the end of it, so it's free-edgar-steele with an E at the end, .com. One of the things you recall was a kike, is that right?
Yes.
And I guess that's a pejorative term for somebody who's Jewish. Are you Jewish?
No, I'm German and Armenian.
Do you have any idea why they might have called you a kike?
I have no idea, except that my husband had the FBI look into it, and it was traced back to the ADL. And at that point, the FBI just said that they weren't going to do anything further on it.
That one phone call or all of the phone calls were traced back to the Anti-Defamation League?
Those particular phone calls were all traced back to the ADL. Those phone calls were by the same person, or at least it sounded like the same person.
The FBI knows for sure that it actually came from the offices of the Anti-Defamation League.
That's what my husband was told, yes. That was 10 years ago, and Ed was the one that was handling most of that because he was trying to protect us. I know that my husband has had many more threats than those, but he has pretty much shielded me and shielded the children from having to endure those threats.
So how many in total did you receive?
We each got one, and then after that, I know that Ed was getting more, but I don't know how many.
Mm-hmm. He didn't want to alarm you, I guess.
He wanted to keep us safe and protected from it. Because when he talked about taking on the Aryan Nation case, we had talked long about the publicity that would happen, and he was under the impression that he would take heat for it, but believed that he could protect his family from it. And when those calls came in, he realized that he couldn't even totally shield his family. And he didn't really represent the Aryan Nations. He represented Richard Butler. That's really not accurate because it was Richard Butler that's who they were going after, his right of freedom of speech, because there were people involved with that that were guilty of the charges, and he was not representing them.
Okay, and Richard Butler is who for our listeners?
Richard Butler was basically the head of the Aryan Nation. He was the one that owned the Aryan Nation grounds. He was the leader and ran that.
Okay, so Ed represented Butler but did not represent the Aryan Nations, that's what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay, so this was in 2000. Anything significant happen over the next several years? Significant, I mean, in the sense that you were getting more threats or that Ed was being targeted by perhaps the ADL or someone else?
Nothing real significant. I mean, he represented other clients based on First Amendment rights and other issues. Probably the most significant that ever since then and during that time, my husband ended up on the watch list of the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the top 40 people to watch. And ever since then, he has remained there and has been watched over by the SPLC.
Okay, and of course, as you said, the SPLC, which is the Southern Poverty Law Center, and you can access that website at splcenter.org, and just go into the search bar and type in Edgar Steele and see for yourself what comes up. Of course, Edgar will come up, and as you said, he was considered one of the 40 to watch. And so when did the Southern Poverty Law Center put Edgar on their illustrious list?
That was shortly after he represented the Aryan Nations.
Okay, so just because he was representing them, he all of a sudden became a white nationalist.
Yes, and that's sort of when Ed started doing a lot of his writings and speaking out, and thus he ended up remaining on that list and is on that list today.
Then, of course, the writing was done from his website, which is conspiracypenpal.com. And on that conspiracypenpal.com website, he wrote an article titled, "It's the Jews, Stupid," which was a play on a political line. Of course, it's the economy, stupid. Is that when the trouble started with the Southern Poverty Law Center?
I think that fueled it, but it had to do with somebody that was blaming the Arabs for everything, and he took a play on, you know, it's the economy, and changed it into that article that he wrote. And my husband does that a lot, plays a lot of puns. He'd use nursery rhymes to make a point. You know, that did not go over well at all.
That was October 7th of 2002. Ed is quite prolific. He writes quite a bit. Now, after he put out It's the Jews, Stupid, and anyone can go to his conspiracypenpal.com website and scroll down and just click more, and you can go down to 2002, like I said, October 7th, and read it for yourself. So that's what really gained the attention of the Southern Poverty Law Center, which classifies people that they don't like in certain categories, hate groups or whatever the case may be. And they don't really have a clear definition for hate. It's quite subjective. Did anything significant happen after that point? And what actually happened? So the Southern Poverty Law Center puts them on their list. Anything happen?
I don't think anything happened other than Ed just continued to write, you know, on political issues, on economy, why he believed issues were happening. So I don't think there was anything significant that, you know, happened. And then in the last few years, he's really has stepped back, one, because of health issues. There was a period of time there that he really wasn't up to writing.
Mm-hmm.
So the last few years, he hasn't been doing a lot of writing. Of course, now he's incapable of writing.
Why don't you tell our listeners about these health issues? When did they start and what exactly were they comprised of?
November 21st, 2009, he had an aortic ascending aneurysm, which by all rights, he should have died that day. But by the miracle, we flew him from Sandpoint to Kootenai County, where he was able to get immediate medical help. He was on a respirator for 9 days. And remained in the hospital after that several more days. When he was finally released, came home and was under the care of a nurse until I could get back home, because in the middle of this, I ended up with my mom in the hospital, who was 450 miles away. That was a six-month recovery period. From that time on, from about the beginning of March, I believe it was, until the beginning of May, he had three other procedures. Two were not as life-threatening, but the last one that he had in May of 2010 was another aneurysm, which was in his head, behind his nose. They had to go in with emergency surgery and put titanium clips on this aneurysm in order so that he would not bleed out. And that's been his health issue. He has not been a well man for 7-8 months.
It started in November of 2009, right?
2009, yes.
Okay, so for a year and several months, he's been ill.
Yes.
Okay, last year in June, and of course, you know the day, it's June 11th, right?
June 11th.
What happened on June 11th, 2010?
At 7 a.m., I had two FBI agents show up at my door. As they're flashing their badges through the window, I stumbled down the stairs because they had actually woke me up. I was still asleep. Opened up the one door. I thought the screen door was locked, which it wasn't, unfortunately, because they opened up the screen door and stepped through the door. And I asked them what they wanted, what was up, and they immediately told me that they needed to talk to me about my husband. I responded that I wasn't going to talk to them about my husband. At which point they told me that he had hired somebody to kill my mother and me that morning, and that there were people out on the road waiting for my mom and I to leave so that they could run us off the road and kill us and make it look like an accident.
Where was Ed when they came to the house at 7 o'clock in the morning?
I was at my mom's house, which was in Oregon. I wasn't home. Ed was up here in Idaho at our home residence.
The FBI tracked you to Oregon, where you were taking care of your mom.
Where I was taking care of my mom, because during this whole time that my husband has been sick, my mom has been in and out with many procedures and was very sick. So I was spending all that time traveling back and forth, taking care of whoever needed the help the most at the time.
Have you ever had any dealings prior to that with the FBI?
Never had any dealings with them.
So when they came to the door at 7 in the morning, you were, needless to say, a little shocked.
I was extremely shocked. And when they realized that I wasn't buying that my husband had hired somebody to kill the two of us, they immediately said to me, well, didn't you have a conversation with your husband last night? Which at that point, my mouth dropped because, yes, I had. And I'm going, how did you know that? And then they proceeded to tell me that I had told him that I was taking my mom to the hospital at 7 a.m. that morning. And that's why they were there at 7 a.m. Well, I was asleep. And at that point, I'm going, well, you're lying to me. I didn't say that out loud, but that's what I was thinking because I never told my husband that in that conversation the night before because I wasn't. I was taking her to the doctor later that afternoon, but I mean later that afternoon. It wasn't adding at that point. They proceeded to keep us under, well, protection, as they would say, and did not let us go until they got verification from the FBI agent up here in Idaho that my husband was arrested and that the people that were going to run us off the road were also taken care of.
So they claim that your husband wanted to have you killed and your mother killed by having somebody run you off the road? Is that what the FBI said initially?
That's what the FBI said initially, yes.
Okay. And then the story changed a bit, didn't it?
It changed a lot.
Tell our listeners about how it changed.
Well, the next few days, I made arrangements for my mom to be taken care of since she was having health issues. I had a friend drive me home because I was so upset, and they were worried about me driving 450 miles by myself and spending time trying to get my husband an attorney for his hearing, which was supposed to be on June 14th, which was a Monday. That got postponed because the courthouses all over Idaho and some in Washington ended up being closed down because they had a delivery of a mystery white powder, which at some point was suggested that Ed was behind that one. Hearing was then moved to June 15th at 4:30. I was not staying at my house because, frankly, I didn't know who was really after me. Everything was telling me that I was not the target, that it was my husband that was the target. And even though my husband was the target, they were using me, and thus I did not feel safe. So I was keeping a low profile. I wasn't staying at the house. I was staying down in Coeur d'Alene. I got up. I decided I was going to check out of the hotel, like 11 o'clock. So I had about 4 or 5 hours to spare. I wasn't going to be pacing. I didn't know what to do. I'd been traveling in my car a lot, so I decided to go have the oil changed in my car. And I'm sitting there in the waiting room while they are changing the oil in my car. And the next thing I know, the mechanic comes out and asks me to follow him, and he had something to show me. You know, my initial response is, great, I've got mechanical problems. I have a major oil leak. How much is this going to cost me? What are they trying to get out of me now?
Right. We've all been in that position before, right?
We've all been in that position. And this is what I'm thinking. And I'm going, I just don't need this. But, you know, okay, I'll go look and see what you want to charge me for this. They take me down underneath the car and they turn me around. And there, a foot away from my face, is this pipe with caps and wire coming out of it. I've never seen a pipe bomb. All of a sudden, it became very real how much danger my life was in. So now it's not me being run off the road. It's somebody trying to blow me up. And I didn't know when it went on my car. I didn't know who put it on my car. I knew my husband was in jail since the 11th, and this was 5 days later or 4 days later.
The mechanic shows you the bomb or what they might think is a bomb. What happened after that?
We had the bomb squad. We had the FBI show up. The mechanics did push the car out of the building. And then we had the bomb squad, the FBI, the police show up. They were making us keep like a 300-yard radius away from it. Of course, the police were questioning me. My son was in his car and had showed up, so they were also questioning him. We went back to the police as they were taking care of the car and the bomb. My son and I were escorted to the police station where we were interrogated. I kept trying to tell them the threats that we had in the past, having no clue of when, where, how. how why that bomb was on my car. I was also saying I need to get to my husband's hearing, which is at 4:30, which they did get me to. So after asking us all the questions, they drove us over to the courthouse where I walked into the courtroom to attend my husband's hearing, which was the first hearing. I'm sitting there and this gentleman comes in and introduces himself as a U.S. Marshal and asks me to come with him. I go out. My son accompanied me. We went into this little conference room where he proceeded to tell me that the government was not going to provide me any protection, even though I had just found a bomb on my car. And I asked when they thought I'd be getting my car back and when my son was going to get his car back, because they also took his car. They told me it was going to be 3 to 4 days before they'd give me my car back. There was a chance my son would get his back later that night. And then they allowed me to go back in the courtroom. That was the day that my husband ended up representing himself, entered a not guilty plea, tried to request bond, and at that point, the assistant U.S. district attorney walks in and says, due to circumstances that have happened, requested that there was a no-contact order put in place between Ed and I, which the judge allowed, and from there, actually a very short hearing. I walked out of the hearing. I took my hand. I slammed it against the wall, saying I needed to be able to speak to my husband and I needed my car back. I was pretty upset. I had already been through a lot. I could tell that my husband didn't have a clue why I was shaking and crying. He knew he was arrested, but he knew that I was sort of over the top. He did not know at that time that I had a bomb on my car. He didn't know what really had been going on with my day that day.
So all this that you just explained, that all happened in the same day then?
The bomb, being told that I wasn't going to be provided protection, being denied the right to even speak to my husband, and that I wasn't going to be getting my car back, being interrogated. Yes, that all happened in one day.
Why do you think it was that the law enforcement official, the U.S. Marshal, had made such a snap decision that you weren't going to get protection, even though this had just happened a short while earlier?
You know, that day, I really had no clue, but as things have progressed and everything in this case has developed, I believe because they are only after one person and they didn't care. The person they're after is my husband. They don't care about what the truth was. They didn't care about protecting me. They had already determined that my husband was responsible for it. Though I did find out much later that night, it was like 9, 10 p.m. that night, that they were checking me out because they were suspecting me of putting the bomb on my own car.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, right?
Yeah, I'm really going to be driving around in a car that I put a bomb on. I wouldn't even know how to even begin to make a bomb. And plus, I would never do anything like that. But they were investigating me because they thought maybe I was trying to do it to save my husband.
So you had just found out about your husband a couple of days earlier, and their rationale was that you would make a pipe bomb and plant it on your own car and then pretend to find it?
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. You found a bomb on your car. What was going through your mind?
I'm not sure what was going through my mind other than I was shaking and I didn't know what to do. I was scared to death. I didn't know who was after me, who was after my husband. I didn't have a clue. And then when they told me that they were not going to provide me any protection, I really felt vulnerable. I felt like I was being abandoned to take care of my own safety. It was unreal because this was like the movies that I watched that are, I don't look as being real. But here I was being presented with this bomb that has been on my car and not knowing how long it had been there.
It just seems a little odd that this U.S. Marshal would make this decision without really investigating the case. It just seems quite suspect that this U.S. Marshal would do this. Ed was in jail from June 11th, and he's in jail right now as we speak, and today is, of course, January 13th. He's in the Spokane County Jail, which, of course, is in Spokane, Washington. Is he in solitary confinement?
There have been people that have told me that he's in solitary confinement, but since I really can't talk to him for a long time and I still am limited on now currently talking to him, I don't know, and I'm not sure what they consider solitary confinement, but I know he has to spend most of his time in his little jail cell by himself with very little time out.
Okay, and of course you do get to see him now, what, once a week, is that right?
I get to see him once a week and have to be babysat by the public defender because he has to record it and make sure that we don't talk about anything we're not supposed to talk about.
Did they charge Edgar with anything yet?
I can't even name off all the charges, but they have so many charges that when you add up all the years, they're going after him for about 70-plus years.
We're going to introduce another person. Supposedly, your husband hired your handyman to kill you and your mom, and the motive was life insurance, right?
That's what they told me.
Was there any life insurance in effect at the time?
No, there hasn't been for a few years. There has been no life insurance on either one of us. We had discussed dropping our life insurance policies, and we both agreed, and thus he dropped them. And there hasn't been any life insurance for the last 2-3 years.
Okay. And why was it that the feds said Ed wanted to kill your mom?
Because he hates her.
Okay. And now the true version?
Well, he doesn't hate her. He has a lot of respect for my mom. You know, my mom was the go-to grandmother, was really the go-to parent. In a lot of ways, he had more respect for my mom than he did his own dad. He loved his mom dearly, but sadly, she had passed away before we even met, so I never did get to know her. But my mom is the one that would come and take care of the kids if we went on vacation, or we'd send the kids to her. I had a daughter that decided she didn't like living at home. Ed decided that the best place, along with my approval, that the best place for my oldest daughter was with my mom. Always asked her for opinions on issues with the children as we were raising them, of what she thought was maybe the best way to handle the different issues. Has over the years helped her out financially and has told me to write her a check, and with the expectation that we will never expect to have that money paid back. And as late as May 20th, 2010, so what, 3 weeks before he was arrested, my husband, on his own, decided that we were going to pay $3,000 to get my mom's house off the foreclosure list because she's been struggling financially. And he knew of her health issues, and we needed to sell the house, but you know what the market is today. And in order to give her more time to hopefully get better health-wise and to get her house sold without losing it to the bank, he came up with the money and paid that $3,000 that got her house off of the foreclosure list to give her more time. And if he had to, he would have come up with more to do that. But at that moment in time, that was what was needed, and that's what we were doing to help my mother out.
There are some people who are familiar with this case who would say that the only reason your mother was brought into it was that she was in a different state, and this ostensible crime then crossed state lines, which would bring the feds in. Is that right?
That has been said, and that is a very good question, because why would he bring my mother into it? That's the only thing that she really establishes, is she makes it cross state lines, which makes it a federal case.
Mm-hmm. So this whole thing, besides, of course, the bomb being found on your guard, at this point is sounding pretty preposterous to you, isn't it?
Extremely. And it's also all the other lies that they keep telling me. They told me that this plot started back in latter part of November, December of 2009. That's when my husband almost died and was on a respirator for 9 days.
These guys really need a new scriptwriter. That's what it sounds like to me. They also told you some other things. They pressured you quite a bit, didn't they?
As far as motive, there was the life insurance, which there is none. Then it was that Ed was having investigator follow me and had pictures of me because I was having an affair. I had a boyfriend. Well, I don't know where you're getting those pictures. I know there's no pictures because there's never been and is not now a boyfriend. And of course, once they finally admitted that there was no life insurance, they then did turn around and tell me, oh, well, apparently there wasn't an investigator and there are no pictures. So when the life insurance didn't work out and me having a boyfriend didn't work out, then they were on to that Ed has a girlfriend and then it's him having the affair. And what they were using to base that on is that even prior to my husband getting sick and it got put on the back burner because of him being sick, was working on a Russian bride human trafficking case. He was trying to find the bad guys. In order to do that, he was having to set himself up as somebody that was interested in Russian brides. And he had several that he was talking about. Well, I knew about it because it is a sensitive matter. He let me know about it. Now, I didn't watch every email that went out or every email that came in, but I knew what it was about, and he was upfront with me, and I knew that it was solely a case that he was handling and developing.
You trusted Ed then, right?
Yes, I did. And I do. And then you have to step back and look at the whole last year, how sick he was. He was in no shape to have a girlfriend. I've been married to him for 25 years and love him and will support him through thick and thin.
Have you had a relatively amicable marriage? Have there been many fights, many disagreements?
We have had, I think, a typical, well, of course, I don't know what's typical, but, you know, we've had our arguments, we've had our disagreements. We did have one rough spot in our marriage, which was over 10 years ago, and it is my belief that it's going to come out in the courts, and they will use that against my husband and me, primarily my husband, since he's the one that asked her. My husband went through a midlife crisis. I filed for a divorce. We went through the court system. We were going to get a divorce, but through that, we ended up recommunicating. It was the only time that I didn't really trust what my husband was doing because he was acting very different than he ever had through our relationship. At that point, we'd been married almost 15 years. We got through it. We started communicating, and we totally dismissed the divorce, and we have been living happily ever since, other than just everyday issues that people deal with. Children, raising them, going through their school issues, and him being sick, my mom being sick. You know, that's what families do. We work together.
And besides, this rough spot that you had in your marriage occurred 10 years before this happened. So how the federal authorities could tie that to this is, again, part of their rather poor script line, I think.
We used the court system. We weren't trying to get rid of each other by offing each other. My husband has always done everything according to the law, and when he has issues, he fights it within the legal system. Might not agree with it, but he fights it within the legal system because, you know, he doesn't believe in violence, never has, does not advocate violence.
You said that you've never had any interaction with the FBI before that day in June. Have you had any run-ins with the law, period, prior to that? Anything significant?
Well, unless you want to call it speeding ticket. But
yes, of course, that's very significant. No, of course.
No, you know, no. I mean, there's been a couple times we've called the police out. We had some guy come and pull our mailbox out of the post and all, and, you know, we've called them out. We've never had any trouble with the law.
What about Ed? Has he ever had any trouble with the law during the time with you or prior?
Well, I can't speak for prior, but not that I know of.
Now, there is one more element that has not been introduced to this discussion, and that is the fella who was ostensibly hired by Ed to do the dirty deed, killing you and your mom. This is a fella by the name of Larry Fairfax, and we mentioned him earlier as the handyman. Tell our listeners about this particular guy. How did he come into your lives, this Larry Fairfax?
started working for us back in 98, 99, off and on. He's a logger, handyman. He's done some excavating work for us. He's logged trees. He's actually added on to a couple buildings, put up a building. But just throughout the years, my husband has hired him to do various things on our place. When Ed came back from the hospital, Ed was having him do things around our place, had him end up taking care of the animals because my situation was having to be gone, taking care of my mom, and my husband was not up to being able to handle those things. He brought Larry on to do the things that I wasn't here to do all the time. And then sort of, it had to be around April, May. This is when Larry, and it might have even been before that, that Larry was starting to file bankruptcy and crying that he was about ready to lose his house, losing all his equipment. So my husband ended up hiring him to do other work on our place to try to give him a helping hand and give him some work so he could put food on the table for his family and, you know, whatever other bills that he was having, hopefully to be able to save his house. So he was doing some barn doors that I needed repaired and other odd things.
But was he introduced to you by somebody?
I believe my husband found him in an ad, but I'm not really sure. When it came to excavating and that was my husband's department.
So Larry Fairfax now is somewhat a regular part of your life, doing work around the house because you're several hundred miles away taking care of your mom. How does Larry Fairfax tie into this arrest of your husband and the FBI and all that stuff?
I mean, my husband and I started getting suspicious of Larry Fairfax prior to everything going down, which was I had left here on May 28th to go back to Oregon because I had come home for a good week and I was home here. About the time I got back to Oregon, Ed had called me and he was asking me how I left certain things in the house, particularly our master bedroom. And I'm going, why? And he said that he felt that somebody had been in our house going through things. He wasn't sure, but he was suspecting Larry Fairfax. He was upstairs in his office, and when he came down, he found doors that were not locked anymore that he knew were locked and things out of place in our master bedroom. And he was pretty upset. He said that he had Larry coming over. The next time I talked to him, I found out from Ed that he had spoke to Larry, and Larry had admitted to coming in our house uninvited, unwelcomed. He was never welcome to just walk into our house. He could go to the barn to feed the animals. Our house was never free reign for him.
Did he take anything?
Well, we weren't aware of it at that time, but also at that time, my husband had found out that he was switching tires on our truck without permission, and I don't know exactly what went down. I just know that Larry was trying to switch out new tires on our truck and putting older tires on it, and Ed was demanding money back, but that was right around the last 2 weeks before Ed's arrest. And later, I found out after I got back and was able to assess our silver savings account that there was about $45,000 at $18 an ounce at that time.
Okay, so he found the silver.
He found the silver, yes. And it's where he had access to, and I'm sure he was out there scrummaging around, you know, and my husband wasn't going outside a lot to check on things, which he always had in the past because he wasn't that healthy during this time. And this was a time that Larry Fairfax was $680-something thousand in debt that he went bankrupt over.
Were you guys aware that Fairfax was in these financial straits when you hired him?
Not back then, but I know about midway in March, April, May, when Larry started crying that he was in financial problems is when my husband started giving him more work to try to help him out. We were trying to be the good guys and help this man out. Instead, he was helping himself.
Larry Fairfax, besides having a tire fetish and going after your silver, he confessed to the FBI that he had planted the bomb on your car, is that right?
He only confesses that the night of the 15th after I found the bomb. Prior to that, on June 8th, he had his attorney, Judge James Michaud, approach the FBI on June 8th that my husband had hired him to kill my mom and me.
Okay, this is significant because who is this judge?
He is a sitting judge in Bonner County, actually a retired judge, but he still sits on the bench occasionally. Took on the job of representing Larry Fairfax, and he's the one that went to the FBI on behalf of Larry Fairfax to tell them that my husband had hired Fairfax to kill me and my mom.
Is there anything else about this Judge Michaud? Did he have anything else to do with the case?
He told the authorities that Ed was the leader of the Aryan Nation. First of all, Ed has never been the leader of any organization, was not part of Aryan Nations. All he did was represent them. But this judge is telling him that Ed is the leader.
And he didn't even represent them, as you said. He just represented one fella.
Yes, he was actually representing just Richard Butler. But it was tied up with the Aryan Nations case.
I guess my question would be, why would a judge who's a heavyweight in the community be wanting to represent Larry Fairfax? And why would this judge point the finger at your husband and claim something as ridiculous as he did? What's his motivation?
That is what I want to know, what his motivation is. Because also Judge James Michaud testified as a judge, got on the stand at Larry's bail hearing to testify in behalf of his client. Attorneys don't get up for their clients to testify on their behalf, but he did. Got on the stand to claim what a good guy Larry Fairfax. He also came out of the interview room on the 15th, and I was standing in the hallway with two FBI agents at the time, and he had just got done with that interview with Larry Fairfax and the authorities. He walks out, and he starts talking to the FBI agents friendly, you know, about fishing, and he was dressed like he had just come off a fishing boat. So I didn't know who this guy was. Anybody at that time, I was sort of standing back because I didn't know who they were, and he looked like somebody that just came off a fishing boat. And he's talking to the FBI agent, so it clued me in that the FBI agents knew who this guy was. He gets into my vicinity close to where I'm standing, and the next thing I know, he turns to me, and he takes his finger, and he's pointed it at me, makes a step towards me, and in a very accusatory voice says, "You're Cindy Steele." I'll tell you, I couldn't back up far enough because I didn't know who this guy was. Upon that, the two FBI agents escort him out before he had a chance to say anything more and got him out the door. That is when I learned who he was. What was he accusing me of finding the bomb on my car? I don't know.
Sounds like the judge is part of the good old boy network there in your neck of the woods.
I know that there have been people that have tried to get him, when he was sitting as a judge, have campaigned to get him off of the bench because I don't know any of the details because I wasn't here at the time, but that he was not a straight-up judge and did some things that were not correct. I can't speak of it because I really don't know. I just know that they were campaigning to get him off of the bench. He's the one that went to the FBI, and as Larry's attorney, it wasn't his obligation to turn Larry in for any of his past crimes that he was divulging. Because remember, they promised to tell the whole truth. But he also, from the 8th of June, never said anything about a bomb being on my car. What did he know, and what did he not tell?
Was he representing Larry Fairfax pro bono?
That I don't know.
What would attract a high-powered judge, obviously part of the good old boy network there, to represent somebody like Larry Fairfax, a handyman who was over $500,000 in debt? That's like the perfect client for Judge Michaud, right?
I mean, that's a good point. You know, that's a point that probably missed. Where's the money coming from that he's being paid to represent Larry? I have no idea. Larry is in our neighborhood. Understand we're out in the very country and we're spread out, but Larry lives out in our neighborhood. Judge Michaud lives out here. I think he's 7 miles away from me, which, I mean, it's not like a neighbor you can shake hands with, but in this territory, that is a neighbor. And then James Marr, who was the guy that accompanied Larry over to Oregon to check on the bomb, lives in this neighborhood. I mean, they all live around me.
If Ed gets off, will you move?
Yes. As soon as we can sell our place, we will move. I mean, of course, he will have his opinion on that, but I don't think there's going to be any issue or problem about him wanting to move. Who would want to stay in this area when they're allowing these people to be out and won't do anything about them?
All the way up to the FBI, right? So they're running you out of town, it sounds like.
Well, feels that way, but I don't need to stay someplace where I don't feel wanted. You know, I can't walk into town. I don't know what James Marr looks like. I go to the post office. I'm constantly looking over my shoulder because I don't know what he looks like. So I'm suspicious of everybody. Unless I know them, then that's one thing. I've had some pretty nasty things said online about me. I'm brainwashed. I'm crazy. I'm an idiot for believing my husband is innocent. They don't have anything valuable to say. They don't come back with any information. They just go to this name calling. But, you know, I don't know who's against me and my husband. I know who's for me and my husband because they know us and who we're about. They know who my husband is about, and they know that that is not him. But these other people, they're taking their assessment off of what our local newspapers print. The FBI claims that they never said anything about a bomb being on my car. Larry Fairfax came clean that night saying that, yes, he had, according to Ed's directive, placed a bomb on my car and on my husband's car. There were two bombs.
Larry Fairfax is, I guess, locked up behind bars right now, right?
Yes, he is.
Okay, and then what's his fate?
Oh, they're giving him a soft plea deal, and what's on the table is 18 months, which will probably end up being time served. They have already agreed to the plea deal, and he will be sentenced on February 7th, and probably will mean he'll be out within less than a year.
You consider your husband to be the target of what appears to be a ridiculous, preposterous murder-for-hire scheme, to me at least, and I'm sure to the listeners when they hear this. What's happening with your husband? Anything happening in the way of hearings?
No, we're just waiting for trial, which is now set for March 7th. He sits in jail, and they're going to let Larry Fairfax, who put this bomb on my car, according to his accounting of it, he put that bomb on my car sometime around the end of May, went to the FBI on June 8th when he agreed to come completely clean about all his criminal activities, and according to the FBI, did not say anything about the bomb and did not admit to even having anything to do with the bomb until June 15th when the FBI went and approached him after I found it. So even though he went to the FBI, as the FBI was telling me that Larry Fairfax was the good guy out to save my life, he was still allowing me to drive around with a bomb on my car. Or for that bomb to be somewhere on the ground between Sandpoint, Idaho, and Portland, Oregon, because they had made a trip over there on May 31st to check on the bomb. And according to the FBI, they went to check to make sure that the bomb was not on my car because he was out to save my life. Well, that bomb was still on my car on June 15th, which means if that was put on there before I went to Oregon on May 28th, for 18 days, I was driving with that bomb on my car. So not only was I in danger, but everybody I passed, every parking lot I stopped in, everybody that rode in that car with me, including some of my children, including good friends, including my mom, and including my 2-year-old granddaughter, were being put at risk. And then if that bomb had fallen off, as they apparently had assumed, it was putting anybody at risk that might have found that bomb and picked it up or ran over it with their vehicle. It is in court documents that that bomb was lethal.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask you. Was the bomb actually able to be detonated? Did they detonate it, or did they just defuse it?
Agent Todd Smith with the BATF&E agency testified that it was a lethal pipe bomb.
So the FBI tells you that Larry is the good guy. He had, I guess we can call it, bomber's remorse. He traveled with somebody to take the bomb off, but then he decided not to after traveling all those hundreds of miles. Let's talk about the evidence. What evidence is there that the government has that can at least prove to a reasonable degree that your husband hired Larry Fairfax to kill you and your mom? Is there any evidence?
They claim that they have three tapes.
Have you heard the three tapes?
I have only heard two tapes.
What happened to the third one?
I heard the two tapes 10 days after my husband was arrested, and when I showed up to listen to those tapes, they immediately told me that the third tape was not ready to be heard. And to this day, even my husband's attorney knows nothing of that third tape, and that third tape has not been presented. And they say that is the one that is very incriminating.
So I guess Larry Fairfax was wired then, ostensibly, right?
Yes, they claim that Larry Fairfax was wired. They have a tape that they say was from June 9th and June 10th and June 11th. I have heard the tape on the 9th, and I have heard the tape from June 10th. The one that was taken on June 11th, I have not heard because they told me the tape was not ready.
The 9th and the 10th, and he was arrested on the 11th, so they want you to believe, or they want the public to believe, that Larry Fairfax taped your husband 2 days before he was arrested, right? Is that what we're saying here? And the day before he was arrested? And the day that he was arrested?
Yes. The FBI claims that they set up the sting in one day because Larry had only gone to the FBI on the 8th.
It's got to be the fastest investigation in FBI history.
Yeah.
You heard the tapes that were ostensibly made on June 9th and June 10th. Are these tapes also on the internet or no?
No, those tapes are not available.
Tell our listeners about what you heard on those tapes.
When I went in, they got it set up and I started listening to it. I don't know, 7 to 12 minutes was hearing them apparently following Larry in his truck driving. And then I could hear where it sounded like he was walking. And I mean, they're telling me that he's walking out to the barn, which I have no reason to not believe that. I then heard things that sounded like feeding, which he was doing, because I could hear gates opening to round pens, and I could hear water, you know, running into the water trough. And then I heard my husband come in, and they're talking about the horses, and they're talking about feeding, and they're talking about this one horse that had gotten hurt, and he has to be in the barn. And frankly, at that point, my stomach dropped because it was sounding exactly like my husband. It was sounding like Larry Fairfax. I prepared myself for the worst. And once they got done talking with that, there was a pause, and then it got very hard to hear. And I ended up having to put my head down on the table so my ear was right against the speaker. It was like all of a sudden all the background noise went away. And I'm listening to what's being said, and as I'm going through listening to the rest of what's being said, I started saying, this is odd. What is odd? And I don't know what was odd, but Ed's voice was not correct. It didn't have the intonations that he normally has. It was hard to hear. And Larry was saying very little. And then a lot of the stuff that I was hearing that they were telling me was so incriminating is stuff that I've heard my husband say before. I want the job done. I have no second thoughts. I want it done now. I have heard him say that to Larry and other people when he decides that he wants a job done on the place and he wants it paid for and my husband is not the most patient and that he wants it done now. I've heard him say that many times.
So what you're saying is you think that they took him saying this one time and they doctored the tape?
I believe they doctored the tape. It's the only reason that it explains why his voice patterns are off. It explains why I was hearing a lot of stuff that I've heard him say, because it didn't make sense. When he'd get to an end of a sentence, it was like end of words were dropped. not the whole word, but the end of word. And my husband is a very clear speaker. If you've ever listened to him online, he has a very strong speaking voice. Mm-hmm. And that is at the point I realized that those tapes are untrustworthy. How they do it, how they did it, I have no idea. But there was such a contrast to the first part of the tape.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all the incriminating stuff where it really changed. I still want to know where the third tape is and what did they have to do in order to get the third tape ready.
Your husband is represented now by a public defender. Shouldn't the attorney through the discovery process be able to get that third tape?
He should be. And when I asked him about it, he said there wasn't a third tape and he didn't know anything about it and he was going to have to look into it.
How long ago was this that you asked him that?
Maybe a month ago.
And did he get back to you about that?
Hasn't gotten back to me about it, no.
Okay, besides these two tapes and the mysterious third tape, is there any other evidence that the government has in their case against your husband?
They are claiming that he tried to tamper with me off of conversations that I had with my husband between the 11th and the 15th of June.
Tell our listeners about that.
When Ed was able to put together what was going on and that there were tapes, he got a hold of my son and had a conversation with my son and got a conversation with me telling me and my son the importance of us not identifying his voice on those tapes. They sound very bad. You know, my husband and I have talked about this exact scenario. I know that he understood that those tapes were going to be manufactured and sound very good. And if I stood up and said that was his voice, that would be the end of it, whether it was his voice or not.
Right, because you might have been in such shock that you might not have been able to logically or dispassionately, objectively analyze these tapes, right?
I was still pretty much in shock during those conversations.
The last thing you're going to be able to do is objectively analyze these tapes. So he was concerned that you might think that it was true, that he really was hiring somebody to kill you, right? I mean, did that go through your mind that there was a possibility?
That went through my mind. I was also a little upset that he didn't have maybe the confidence in me that I would honestly listen to those tapes and question them thoroughly. Before I even heard the tapes, I was questioning him. The FBI agent could testify to it if he would. The day that he was talking to me on the 11th and the day after when I was trying to listen to the tapes that weekend, I was telling him I didn't trust those tapes because I didn't trust that those tapes were authentic because I didn't believe my husband did it. I also knew the biggest question I had was, God, could I really be that wrong? I don't believe my husband did it, but what if I'm wrong? And I knew, despite what my husband said to me and despite what I believed, I knew that I had to go in and listen to those tapes and be honest because the bottom line was, is this meant my life? You know, my life was in very much jeopardy, and I had to go in and listen to those tapes as if I had no preconceived opinion of them. And that's how I went in. And like I said, when I heard the first part, my stomach was dropping because I was feeling like, God, I was wrong. And it was only after I got through that part and started realizing that the incriminating part was off and very much different than the first part of the tape that I realized that those tapes were not authentic.
Do you want to take a little break?
Oh, sorry.
No, please, just...
Yeah, this gets me going when I talk about it because it just brings it all back up.
It's a lot to run through again.
And those two recordings, one of the local news stations, those recordings of the jailhouse where they say he was tampering with me are online because immediately those tapes, which were conversations that were made with somebody in prison, were turned over to the media immediately and was broadcasted all over the county.
Who did that?
Well, the only people that had access to those tapes was the government.
So they leaked the tapes to the media to make you guys look bad?
Yes, and that happened immediately.
The trial, you said, is slated to begin in March?
March 7th. It was originally slotted for November 7th. His attorney, the public defender, asked for a continuance of 6 months, and the judge gave it until March 7th. It still could be put off longer than that, but the judge indicated that he would be giving no more continuances, and this judge is known for that. The public defender wanted more time to look into investigating things, so I feel like he's been sitting on things, unfortunately.
So the public defender really doesn't sound like he's doing the job that he should. Are you making other arrangements for perhaps what might be considered a more high-powered, aggressive attorney to make sure your husband doesn't spend the rest of his life in jail?
Since about September, we have been trying to fundraise money so that we can bring on a high-powered attorney. It has been figured that it's going to take $250,000. We have raised only about $67,000 to date, and I don't sneeze at that because there have been people from Australia, Japan, Canada, probably every state in the United States that has been graciously sending in their donations.
How does that make you feel when you get money from strangers from all over the world?
It makes me feel like I have support and people that know my husband through his writings and his book. Several of them are people that have met him personally. It makes me feel like I'm not totally alone in defending my husband, and it helps. And I appreciate every penny that they have sent. I've had people send in $5, you know, in a writing, I wish I could give more, but this is out of my Social Security check. I've had people give as large a donation as $1,000, and I appreciate every penny of that. You know, everybody is giving what's in their means, and I have people that are continually sending in donations, $50 this month, $50 the next month in support, and that makes me feel good. But at the same time, I worry that we're not going to get enough to properly defend him. We do have an attorney online, and somehow, some way, we are going to get him on board.
Let's say some of our listeners listening to this broadcast are interested in helping with your legal battle. How can they get some money to you?
Best way is to visit the website that we have set up for freeing Ed, and that is at free-edgar, E-D-G-A-R, hyphen, Steele, S-T-E-E-L-E, .com. There is a link on there where people can send donations through PayPal. If they don't want to use PayPal, they can mail in donations to Edgar Steele Defense Fund at Post Office Box 1255, Sagel, S-A-G-L-E, Idaho, 83860. There are people that have formed a corporation, Edgar Steele Defense Fund Corporation, that is handling all donations. Even though I'm not part of the corporation, I am the one that is overseeing the money and making sure that the board is getting the money directed strictly to his defense. I am personally taking all book orders, money that was received from his book orders, and applying that to his defense.
Now, the book, you mentioned the book. He's an author. He's a published author. What is the name of the book?
The name of the book is Defensive Racism.
And what's it about?
It's really about how we protect ourselves in today's economy and through what is coming. And he wrote this book back in 2003, I believe. Mm-hmm. And there are things that he has predicted in that book that sadly are starting to come true. What's scary is what he predicts for this country as time goes on, what's yet to come in his book. I can tell you that I hope it doesn't come true. I can tell you my husband hopes that it doesn't come true. And it's basically based on providing protection for ourselves, taking care of ourselves economically. And he relates it to past history of how we're repeating history, i.e. the gun laws. Germany was taking gun rights away from people before Hitler came into power. Right now, we have people in this country that are trying to take away our gun rights. And they're going to succeed if we keep having things like what just happened in Arizona.
So the book, Defensive Racism, can be purchased off of the freeedgarsteele.com website, is that right?
Yes, there is a link there for the book, And all the money that is raised from his books, I am taking and putting in towards his defense.
So all the proceeds from the book sales are going to the defense. I'm looking at the website right now, Free Edgar Steele. At the top, the tabs home, background, blog, donations/t-shirts, book, and contact. And there's a picture there, of course, of the whole family smiling and happy, and that's the way we would want it to be soon,
and
hopefully.
That picture was taken the summer before he got so ill.
The town that you said people could send the donations to, that's Sagle with an S, right? That's S-A-G-L-E, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so right here at the top where the tabs are, as I mentioned before, home, background, blog, donations/t-shirts, book, and contact. If you click on donations/t-shirts, there's a nice picture of Ed. And it says, help us out, PayPal, or of course any credit cards or snail mail. And of course you have Ed's address in Spokane, Washington. Can folks write a letter to him?
They cannot write a letter. The only thing that they are allowed to send now is a postcard. And the postcard has to have their return address with their full name on it. You cannot abbreviate your name. You have to put your full name and your full address on it, and it can only be a postcard.
Why?
Well, we don't really know. They implemented that about halfway through after he was arrested. It used to be you could send letters, but now you can only send postcards.
He might be trying to smuggle a file in the envelope so he could file his way out of jail.
Believe me, even when they were getting letters, they open and copy everything that goes in and out of that jail.
That's very nice of them. So you can send a postcard to Edgar, and the address is right here in Spokane, Washington. As I just mentioned, there is $67,000 in change to date, which, like you said, that's nothing to sneeze at, from folks all over the country who are interested in this case and interested in the First Amendment. You need to get to about a quarter of a million. What's all this money going to be used for primarily?
Expert witnesses. We need to have the tapes analyzed. We need to have an investigator, because we do have people out there that we need to try to find that has information that would be valuable to Ed's case. And we need to have the bombs analyzed. We need a bomb expert. We need to find out the criminal activities of Larry Fairfax and his accomplices, who they refuse to do anything about. The guy that actually traveled with Larry Fairfax clear to Oregon to check on the bomb, so who knew about the bomb on May 31st and also decided to not come forward and allowed me to travel with this bomb on my car. They refused to do anything about him, and he lives on my street.
That's nice. And
the two people that they claim that were ready to run my mom off the road that they said that they have, they don't have them. And now, even though they told us that they had them and that they were no longer a danger to me and my mom, and had told us that they were there ready to run us off the road, they now claim that they don't exist and that they never told us that.
I have a stupid question. Isn't the public defender supposed to be doing any of these things?
Well, yes.
And?
To date, I don't think he's defending my husband as good as he should be.
Well, obviously. You would think that he would at least demand this third tape.
We have sent him information. My attorney got an anonymous phone call that said that he knew Larry Fairfax and James Marr, the person that accompanied Larry Fairfax over to check on the bomb on my mom's place on May 31st, that he knew them and that Larry Fairfax had told the FBI about the bomb ahead of time, and that both of them, Fairfax and Marr, had something on the FBI, which we have turned over to the U.S. Attorney's Office immediately. In fact, in a meeting that my attorney and I had with Tracy Whalen, the assistant U.S. District Attorney, when we played that for her, she laughed at it in front of me as if we were being ridiculous and it was unconceivable and it was just hilarious. You know, it really angered me, because I don't see anything about this case funny. My life was in danger. They are prosecuting my husband wrongly. They're not protecting me. They're lying to me. There are so many lies that they have told me. They also denied me my crime victim rights when it came to the plea deal for Larry Fairfax. I, as a crime victim, had the right to object to the plea deal They notified me on August 24th, which I called immediately to object to that. I had to leave a message on the Assistant U.S. District Attorney's voicemail, and I didn't get called back from her. I got called back from a victim specialist that was assigned to me.
So if you're a victim of a crime in Idaho, you have the right as the victim to object to the perpetrator's sentence? Is that what you're saying?
I have the right to object to a plea deal. Not that they will listen to it, but I have the right to stand up and say, I object, and this is the reasons why I don't believe your plea deal is acceptable. Now, I got noticed on August 24th. They had signed the plea deal on August 18th.
Does your lawyer think that anything could be done about this?
We immediately, upon finding that out, I and then my mom also filed affidavits objecting to the hearing that was going to happen in regards to the soft plea deal, which did get postponed for another month. I have filed a complaint about my crime victim rights being denied. And despite all that, they are still going through. The judge has okayed the soft plea deal because they refused to charge Larry Fairfax with anything other than the manufacturing and possession of a firearm. They refused to charge him with attempted murder. And my understanding is that there's actually several other charges that they could charge him with, but they have no interest in doing that because they know that they need him as a witness on the stand when my husband's trial comes.
This is going to go in front of a jury, right?
My husband will go in front of a jury. The only thing Larry is waiting on now is where the judge will actually sentence him. The two charges that they did charge him with, actually each one carries a sentence of 10 years. So that is 20 years. They have signed a plea deal of only 18 months.
Because it sounds like that Larry Fairfax is being used by the government to get to Edgar Steele. Larry Fairfax is going to be sentenced in a couple of weeks. Your husband's trial is set to begin March 7th. It may or may not begin on that date, but it looks like it will. Are there any indications of how long the trial is going to last?
The government asked for 3 days. Ed's defense asked for 2 weeks. So the judge is allowing 2 weeks.
The government believed, or perhaps they use that as some kind of a tactic, that they could put Ed in jail in 3 days?
Yes.
From everything that you've explained, the tape that never materialized, the star witness, Larry Fairfax, with all his baggage. In fact, has he been accused of being an FBI informant in the past?
We have had people that have told us that he has been an FBI confidential informant, and they believe that he was a confidential informant as far back as 10, 11 years ago.
We've got less than 2 months to go before the trial. Free-Edgar-Steele, with an E at the end, that's STEELE.com. And on there in the top right-hand side, you'll see donations/t-shirts. If you have access to the internet, you can, of course, donate here online. Click here to help out using PayPal. You could use PayPal or I believe you use other credit cards. If you don't have access to the internet and you are not hearing this interview on the internet, you're hearing it somewhere else, you can send whatever you'd like to send. Like Cindy said earlier, people send a couple of dollars, whatever they can do, to the Edgar Steele Defense Fund, care of Proper Press, that's P-R-O-P-E-R, Proper Press, P.O. Box 1255, Sagal, S-A-G-L-E, that's S as in Sierra. Sagal, Idaho, 83860. Right now, the defense fund is at $67,000. The attorney that Cindy is looking to utilize in the defense of Edgar, her husband and her children's dad, estimates that they will need about $250,000 in order to hire the experts needed to refute the government's evidence, with quotes around it.
And there's something else that I would like to put in here. Yes, I am strongly working towards defending my husband, But as my husband has stood up for the freedom of speech and the First Amendment, this is also for all of us, because this isn't the first time that the government has tried to put away and has succeeded putting away innocent people just because of what they believe and what they have stood up for. And we need to put a stop to it, because they're going to continue it. It could be you next. It could be even me next, because I am now taking my husband's place and standing up for our freedom to believe what we believe and have the right to say it. And your donation is a help toward everybody's right to freedom of speech, and that we can continue to speak out.
Well, let me just say that listening to you tell the story, I'm interested in donating, and perhaps I shouldn't, as somebody who should, I guess, stay objective, but this is something very important for all of us, because the government will continue to abuse citizens of this great country. If nobody says anything, I guess we deserve what we get.
And innocent people don't deserve this. They do not deserve what they are bringing down just because they don't like what we say.
Politically incorrect.
Yes, politically incorrect. You know, it doesn't matter if we're telling the truth. They don't want to hear it, and the only way that they can fight it, because they're afraid of what the truth is by silencing us. And they are doing their best by putting innocent people away when they don't like what they hear, because it goes against their beliefs, which they have the right to speak out about. They have the right to say how they feel and what their beliefs are, but they don't want to hear our beliefs and what we see as not being correct in this country.
I should have asked earlier, how is your mom doing?
My mom is not doing very well. She continues to have health problems, which this has really taken a toll on me to be able to be there as much as I need to be there for her, because I have to put time into defending my husband. She's had many health issues, and in a week she's going to have to start chemo, which will go on for 6 months. And I worry if whether she is strong enough to be able to hold up under the chemo because of all her health issues. So it's a tough time all the way around right now.
Everything's happening all at once, it seems. How about the kids? How are they faring in all this?
They're dealing, but it's having its effect on all of them. My youngest is depressed a lot of the times because that's her dad. She worries about the day, I mean, she doesn't have a boyfriend, but she worries about the day that she walks down the aisle and she doesn't know if her dad will be there. My son misses having his dad's advice and being able to talk to him. He's a young man now and looks to his dad for advice, and it's hard to get it when he's in jail. My oldest, she's a little bit more removed. She's been moved away from home and has her own family, but it's had its toll on her. My granddaughter isn't being able to learn and know her grandpa. It's hard on all of us. And they're worried about me because they know that I'm struggling, and without my husband and with having to not only work towards his defense, but take care of our place and try to keep things going. And that's without an income anymore. He was the money earner, wasn't earning a lot because he's done so much pro bono work, which is fine. I've always supported him in that, but it's hard. You know, there's so many issues that come up when you don't have your team. Ed and I work as a team, and we always have. And I've had issues like running out of propane and having the fireplace go out on the blink, you know, all the stuff that he's handled. And it seems minor compared to what he's having to go through and being in jail. But when I'm out here trying to survive and handle everything, it's pretty tough. But I will do it. I will stand on my two feet, and I will get through this, and we will get through to the other side of this, because I have no choice, because my husband is innocent, and I have to do what it takes to get him free and to hold my life and our place together, so when he is free, we can continue our partnership through the rest of our lives.
You see him once a week, right?
I saw him last Friday. I get to see him once a week. I am going to see him tomorrow, but it's very limited. I mean, I get to stare at him through a glass wall. And we get to talk about the unimportant things, as he puts it, because when I go to see him, his attorney has to accompany us and babysit us to make sure that we don't say anything that we're not supposed to, which is anything about the case. He has to record our conversation, and that recording then goes to the judge. And if the judge thinks she hears us talking about anything that we shouldn't be talking about, she can put the full no contact order back in place.
And how's he holding up?
Physically, he actually looks better than he has in a long time. Like he says, he has nothing better to do than to rest, sleep, lay around. Mentally, he's having it hard. He has some days where he's very depressed, and he seems to be up when I go and see him. He says that his best days is when he gets to see me, but that lasts one day, and then it's another week before he can see me. I can't put my arms around him. He can't put his arms around me. Yeah, we can put our hands up against each other with the glass in between, but, you know, it's not the same. And having to censor everything that we say is pretty hard, because we've always talked about anything and everything.
Let me give one more time the information to our listeners. This is important. free-edgar-steele.com. On that website, you'll see some tabs on the upper right-hand side. Home, background, blog, donations, t-shirts, book, and contact. Of course, you can read the background here of this case. If you think you've heard enough, that you're comfortable with the information that you've been given by Edgar's wife, Cindy, and you want to make a donation, just click on the donation tab. And you can send a donation using PayPal online or a credit card online, or if you'd rather do it via snail mail through the U.S. Postal Service, you can send whatever amount you'd like. As Cindy said, people send $5, and they say that's all I can send because of my Social Security, whatever the case may be. And she's up to about $67,000. They need about $250,000, and it would go to Edgar Steele Defense Fund, care of Proper Press, P.O. Box 1255, Sagle, S-A-G-L-E, Idaho, 83860. Cindy, I want to thank you so much for the time you spent explaining all this to our listeners.
Well, I thank you for giving me the time to tell my husband's story and my story, because our best defense is really exposure and getting the word out, because they're not going to stop at silencing my husband. They're going to continue, and it's wrong. They are wrongly accusing my husband, and we need to not let them continue to do this to him or to others, and to let the true criminals get away with it. I mean, the true person that tried to murder my mother and I is going to be out shortly, and I don't know what I'm going to do about that one, because I live in his neighborhood.
free-edgar-steele.com. That's Steele with an E at the end. Donations is in the right-hand side. Click that. You can donate online, or you can donate via the U.S. Postal Service, the Edgar Steele Defense Fund, care of Proper Press, P.O. Box 1255, Sagle, S-A-G-L-E, Idaho, 83860. And it's free-edgar-steele.com, free-edgar-steele.com. Best of luck, Cindy.
Thank you very much, Dave.